when this event was held a year ago, we were almost exactly 1 year into the world financial crisis. Markets were under strain and risk pricing had increased. But as difficult as conditions were at that time, the most severe phase of the crisis still lay ahead. The year since then has turned out to be the most eventful that I think any of us would wish to see in our lifetimes. It was marked by periods of exceptional volatility in financial markets, the failures of some major financial institutions in the United States and Europe, and a range of extraordinary steps taken by governments around the world to support their financial sectors and to rebuild confidence. Today, I want to take the opportunity of reviewing some of those events and looking at how they have affected the financial system in Australia. My main themes are easy to summarise. The most intense phase of the crisis extended over roughly the six-month period that followed the collapse of Lehman Brothers in September last year, so roughly from September 2008 to March this year. Since then, market conditions around the world have improved quite significantly, though they're still by no means back to normal. The crisis events, although they didn't originate in Australia, have created significant challenges for the Australian financial system. Nonetheless, throughout this period, the performance of the Australian financial system has held up better than its counterparts in the major economies abroad. Let me begin with a few observations about how all of these events unfolded. The origins of the crisis have been much discussed, and explanations for it have tended to focus on four main sets of factors. The first of these was the extended period of low interest rates that prevailed in the major economies earlier in this decade. While we can still debate the reasons for those policy settings, they're likely to have contributed to the build-up of debt and of financial risk-taking in the period leading into the crisis. Second were various features of credit markets that became increasingly prominent during this period, which were adding to the accumulation of risk. Things like the rapid growth of originate and distribute lending and of markets for structured securities, along with a general deterioration of lending standards. Third were regulatory shortcomings in some of the major countries that permitted all of these risks to build. Finally, and central to any episode of this nature, was excessive risk-taking by investors themselves. This last point prompts me to make a more general observation, and that is that financial cycles, with their inherent tendency to generate overstretch and then retreat from risk-taking, have been around for as long as financial activity itself. The common features of these cycles are well recognised. They include, in the up phase, a general sense of optimism, a heightened appetite for financial risk, rising asset values, and increasing leverage as both the demand for credit and the supply of credit increase. All of those features were present in global markets in the lead up to the current crisis period, and they set the stage for the severe correction that then followed. We can get a useful summary of these developments from looking at the evolution of credit spreads and risk premia in the major global markets, which is what's illustrated in my first slide. By early 2007, bond spreads in traditionally high-risk instruments like emerging market sovereign debt and US junk bonds had fallen to around their lowest levels in a decade. In both cases, they narrowed by around 400 basis points over a four-year period in response to strong demand from investors. All of this was part of the much-discussed search for yield in global investment markets at the time. No doubt it was fueled in part by perceptions on the part of investors that the risks associated with these instruments had genuinely declined. But there also seems to have been an increased investor appetite for risk during this period, encouraged by the environment of low global interest rates. Subsequently, of course, as you can see on the chart, these spreads blew out dramatically as the crisis unfolded, although, as we can also see, and I'll come back to this point later, we've seen a significant narrowing of these spreads and signs of improved confidence over the past few months. The same general pattern that I've just described we can see also in interbank money market spreads in this next chart. By early 2007, these had compressed to levels not much above zero in the major markets. But in the crisis period, they widened to unusually high levels as both the perception of risk and the desire to avoid risk increased. And I should add here that for the period of most extreme stress, these indicative spreads are in any case rather academic because these markets were largely closed in the major countries during this period, as were markets for longer term bank funding. It's also interesting to note while I'm on this chart that the markets right through this period generally took a more favourable view of Australian banks than they did of banks in other countries, and that's a point again which I'll come back to a bit later. The immediate trigger for the most intense phase of the crisis was the series of failures or near failures of major world financial institutions that occurred in September last year, centred on the collapse of Lehman Brothers. Other prominent names during that month were Fannie and Freddie and AIG in the United States and Fortis in Europe. It was a time of exceptional turmoil. The peaks in credit spreads in most markets occurred shortly after the Lehman failure, but they remained extremely high for some months afterwards. These developments in credit markets brought on a wider collapse in confidence, not just in financial systems, but in business and household sectors in the major economies more widely. In the 6 months post-Lehman, equity prices in the major economies fell to levels between 30 and 50% below where they'd been at the start of 2008. And indicators of business and consumer confidence also fell sharply, as did spending and production levels in a number of the major economies. It was during this period that governments around the world stepped up their efforts to support their financial systems, and they did that by taking a number of extraordinary measures to provide guarantees for deposits and wholesale funding by banks. The Irish government was the first to act in this way in late September 2008, when it provided a guarantee with an unlimited cap for deposits in its large institutions. This was an approach that was also followed by Austria and Denmark. In a number of other countries, including the United States, the UK, and some other European countries, existing caps on depositor protection were significantly increased. Around the same time, many governments moved to offer guarantees for wholesale funding, subject to various guarantee fees. Australia took these steps at around the same time as other countries in October last year, with the arrangements becoming fully operational in late November. We can see the effects of all these developments on the ability of Australian banks to access funding in wholesale markets in the data shown in this next chart. In the months immediately following the Lehman collapse, these markets were effectively closed, not just to Australian banks, but to the global banking system in general. Issuance of term debt by Australian banks fell from an average of $12 billion a month in the first half of last year to virtually nothing by November. But with the availability of the guarantee from late 2008, banks were again able to raise funding in substantial volumes in term markets, both domestically and offshore. Guaranteed issuance was particularly strong in the early months of the scheme as banks accelerated their funding and sought to lengthen the maturity structure of their liabilities. The guarantee ensured that Australian banks were able to maintain access to capital markets during this period, and as a result, the availability of funding hasn't generally been a constraint on their ability to lend during the crisis period. Overall, the various guarantee arrangements that were put in place around the world played an important part in stabilising conditions after the extreme dislocation that occurred last September. It should be remembered, though, that these were emergency arrangements and they were designed to be temporary. Most countries have set expiry dates for their schemes, and most commonly these are set for later this year for the wholesale component. The pricing structure of the guarantees should also be thought of as an important part of the exit mechanism, with the guarantees generally being priced at levels designed to become unattractive to borrowers as market conditions normalise. In this regard, it's encouraging to note that Australian banks have again begun to issue significant amounts of unguaranteed debt in the last month or so. As I said earlier, the most intense phase of the global crisis was in the six-month period from September last year to March 2009. There have been a number of more positive signs in the period since then. Equity markets have regained quite a bit of lost ground, with the major markets up by between 40 and 50% from their troughs in March, as you can see in this chart here. Related to that, there's been a significant rebound in indicators of business and consumer confidence. And credit spreads and risk premia in the global markets have been narrowing, although, as I said, they're not yet back to normal. In making these observations, I have to give the usual caution that the situation is still uncertain and setbacks are still possible. But without making any predictions, it's reasonable to say that there are encouraging signs now that confidence is improving. I want to turn now to my second theme, which is the performance of the Australian banks. Throughout the crisis period, the Australian banking system has proven to be much more resilient than its counterparts abroad. One obvious point of comparison is bank profitability, which for the major international countries are illustrated in this next slide here. This is not always a popular point to make, but it's a great advantage during an economic downturn to have a banking system that remains profitable and is able to continue lending. In 2008, the major banks in the US and Europe moved sharply into loss, though some have returned to profit this year. And you can see here that the major UK banks were particularly hard hit, but there were also large system-wide losses across the United States and Europe. Australian banks, in contrast, as we can see here, have so far experienced only a small decline in their aggregate profitability, and they continue to earn a high rate of return on shareholders' equity overall. What explains this greater resilience? One important point is that it's closely tied up with the relative performance of the economy itself. In other words, the strength of the banking and financial system has been both a contributor to and a consequence of Australia's relatively good economic performance during this period. So one reason why banks have experienced relatively small asset losses is that the economic downturn in Australia has been nowhere near as severe as has happened elsewhere. But even allowing for that, it seems clear that Australian banks generally had stronger balance sheets coming into the crisis period and less exposure to high-risk assets than many of their international counterparts. This has been particularly evident in banks' lending for housing. Although there has been some pickup in housing loan arrears for Australian banks, the overall impairment rate remains very low. It currently stands at just over 0.6 of 1%. This is likely to rise further in the current environment, but it's still well below comparable figures in many other countries illustrated in this chart. In the United States, for example, the legacy of high-risk lending has contributed to a build-up in non-performing housing loans from less than 1% of banks' loan book to a current level of 5%. In the UK, the figure is 3%. We can give a number of reasons for the relatively favourable position of Australian banks on this front. Structural features of the Australian housing market have probably helped to make borrowers and lenders more conservative than they are in some other countries. Unlike in parts of the United States, for example, housing loans in Australia are full recourse both in law and in practice, so borrowers have a stronger incentive to avoid overcommitting themselves and also to avoid default. In addition, consumer credit laws in Australia put some responsibility on the lender to avoid putting borrowers in a position of overcommitment. A further point is that the Prudential Regulator took steps in recent years to increase capital requirements on riskier types of mortgages. It's hard to be definitive about the relative contributions made by these different factors that I've just mentioned, but what does seem clear is that the combination of legal, regulatory and structural characteristics of the Australian mortgage sector made it much more conservative in its behaviour over recent years than some of its overseas counterparts. Low DOC and non-conforming loans, for example, were always a very small part of the Australian market, particularly in comparison with subprime mortgages in the United States. Another important factor here has been the timing of the Australian housing cycle. Australia experienced its last major housing boom in the 2002-2003 period. For a number of years after that, the market went through a period of correction when house prices were either falling or were rising more slowly than incomes. This was also a period when construction of new housing has been fairly subdued. As a result of all of that, the twin problems of overpricing of housing and overbuilding that occurred in the United States in the run-up to the crisis were avoided in Australia. A further point here is that, as well as having smaller loss rates than in some other countries, housing lending in Australia forms a relatively big part of banks' overall loan portfolios. Currently, housing loans account for around 60% of Australian banks' on-balance sheet loans, compared to figures of around 35% in both the United States and the UK. Now, none of this is to deny that there has been some decline in the overall asset quality of Australian banks. Impairment and loss rates have increased noticeably for business loans, particularly to the commercial property sector. Nonetheless, banks' overall stock of non-performing assets remains quite low, at around 1.5% of their total assets. The Australian banking system is well capitalised, and many of the banks have strengthened their capital positions further with new raisings over the past year. Among the top 100 international banks, Australia's four majors remain part of only a very small group to be rated AA or higher. So the asset side of the balance sheet has been comparatively resilient, certainly when compared with banks in the United States and Europe. The main way that Australian banks and other deposit takers have been affected by the international crisis has been on the funding side. I talked earlier about the disruptions that occurred in wholesale credit markets. One important consequence of all that has been an increase in banks' wholesale funding costs relative to the cash rate. Heightened competition for deposits has also been adding to banks' relative funding costs. There were also some significant flows in deposit markets, reflecting the extreme risk aversion that took hold during much of 2008. This next rather complicated graph shows the shares of the Australian deposit market accounted for by the different institutional groups. The four major banks gained market share during 2008, with much of that change occurring prior to the announcement of the guarantee, as depositors engaged in a shift to perceived safety. The regional banks also gained market share. Most of the gains by Australian banks were at the expense of branches and subsidiaries of foreign banks. credit unions and building societies lost some market share in the period leading up to September, but this stabilised after the announcement of the guarantee. There's been some interest in how the guarantee itself might have affected these market shares. If we look at the absolute level of deposits, as illustrated in this next chart, it makes it clear that proportionately, the regional and other smaller Australian banks experienced the largest growth in deposits in the period after the guarantee was announced. The disruptions to funding markets during the crisis period have also had an effect on lending patterns. One example of that has been in housing lending, where the effective closure of securitisation markets has had a pronounced effect on market shares. Wholesale lenders and the smaller banks that rely significantly on securitisation markets to fund their lending have lost market share during the crisis period. To a lesser extent, so have the credit unions and building societies, while the major banks have made substantial gains. To put that in some perspective, this has followed a lengthy period when the major banks were losing market share, and the recent movements can be expected to start unwinding as securitisation markets recover. In any case, these developments don't seem to have resulted in any shortage of housing finance in aggregate. Over the past 6 months, loan approvals for housing have increased by more than 20% in an environment where the market for established houses has been strengthening. Let me say a few words about the regulatory environment before finishing. I've made the point that financial cycles are not new. They've been around for as long as financial activity itself, and they've centred around a wide variety of different assets over the years, whether they be railway shares, commercial property, tech stocks, or subprime mortgages. The one thing we can be sure of is that the next bubble will be different from the last one. Financial regulation can't hope to eliminate this behaviour entirely, but the effort has to be made to contain system-wide risk within reasonable bounds. Governments and regulators around the world are doing a lot of work to draw lessons from the crisis so as to ensure that the system is more robust in the future. Australia is participating in the discussions on these issues in various groups, including the G20, the Financial Stability Board, and the Basel Committee on Banking Supervisions. Many of the details are still being worked out. Nonetheless, it's fairly clear where the main thrust of these global deliberations is heading. We're moving into a world where banks are going to be required to hold more capital and to take less risk. Regulators will be asking for higher liquidity resources, and they'll be paying greater attention to the way risks interact across the financial system, in addition to the conventional focus on the safety of individual institutions. In all of this, there's a balance to be struck. More demanding regulation of banks' capital and liquidity and risk-taking will make the core of the system safer, but it will also add to banks' cost of doing business and to the incentive to shift business into the less regulated parts of the system. It's going to be important to get this balance right. Let me conclude by briefly reiterating my main messages. In the last year, we've seen globally the biggest financial disruption in more than a generation. By far the most intense phase of the crisis occurred during roughly the six-month period following the Lehman collapse in September last year. Conditions now are still very challenging, and I'm wary of making predictions. But in the past few months, there have been encouraging signs of improvement, and Australian banks to date have come through all this in better shape than most. Thank you again for the invitation to speak today, and thank you for listening.
You mentioned that market share moves towards the banks will unwind as securitisation markets recover. Do you think that that should be allowed to happen naturally, or would you like to see continued government support of competition outside the Big Four? And if so, what form should that take? Should it be a continuation of the AOFM program or guarantee of RMBS issues?
Thanks. I think my general view on that is that we should expect these market shares to evolve naturally. As I said earlier, there has already been some significant improvement in market conditions over the last few months. We should keep in mind that the various assistance measures that were put in place in the period following September last year were always designed to be temporary. They were emergency measures. They were put in place in a world where confidence, and this is not particularly an Australian phenomenon, but globally, confidence was severely impaired. There was all sorts of unhelpful speculation going on about whether financial institutions were safe. Governments had to take emergency measures to shore up confidence in the system and to make sure that the core of the system was able to maintain stability, continue functioning and continue lending. But as I said, things now are improving, and I think the priorities now should be to think about promoting normalisation, which means thinking about how to get off guarantees, how to make sure that they are a temporary arrangement, not a permanent one. I made the comment that the design of the guarantees themselves was actually set up with the pricing feature in it that would make the guarantees unattractive over time as conditions normalise. That process now, I think, is well underway. It's got further to go, but I think governments should be thinking about how to promote normalisation of conditions, and that's really the priority rather than looking for more ways to intervene to prop up institutions. I think that phase now, that was very sorely needed back in September last year, but that phase now is behind us.
Thanks. Caris Palmer from Retail Banking Review. Just ahead of the Payment Systems Board meeting on Friday, are you able to make a general comment on whether the bank is satisfied with the level of innovation occurring in Australian banking?
There's not very much that I can say about that. What you're referring to is that there's a very important set of decisions to be made by the Payment System Board on Friday. It's been signalled in the review of retail payments that the Payment System Board issued in September last year. What's happening there is that the board will review progress in the industry's various moves to promote competition in retail payments, and at that point the board will be making a decision about whether there is a case to step back from interchange regulation. I can't preempt that decision. I think it would be inappropriate to do that, so I won't comment further on that.
Andrew Robertson from the Late Line Business Program at the ABC. At the end of your talk, you talked about getting the balance of future regulation right. In your mind, how would that look? How would that correct balance look? And could you just elaborate on the risks you see of not getting it right, please?
I'm really making a very general point here that there are trade-offs involved in any regulatory regime, and not specifically referring to Australia here, but I think that some countries are now realising that they erred too far in a direction of under-regulation in the area of systemic risk, and so there were certain risks that became apparent during the financial crisis, which with hindsight it would have been better if the regulatory regimes in some of the major countries had had more robust safeguards against that. So it's natural that people around the world are thinking about how do you put things in place that will limit risk-taking in any future financial cycle? And the obvious things to do there are the ones that I mentioned, which are tougher capital standards, tougher liquidity standards, and tougher monitoring of risk-taking by the core institutions in the financial system. So all of those things are being looked at. And when all the debate is running in that direction, I think there is some risk that people lose sight of the fact that trade-offs are important as well. And so people need to keep in mind that increasing the regulation on financial institutions in those directions does impose costs on them as well, and people should be keeping those trade-offs in mind as they think about what's the right balance to strike.
Do you think it will take a long time for consumer confidence in the non-bank sector to recover, even when securitisation markets do come back?
I can't really give predictions about how quickly confidence might recover. I think if we'd been having this conference back in February or March this year, I'm sure that the mood around the room would have been pretty dire, because confidence was very low everywhere, and it wasn't clear that at that point that we were going to pull out of this quickly. I think we can be we can feel a lot better about these things now than we would have felt back then, and I tried to indicate a number of areas where we are seeing some concrete signs of confidence improving. I could have mentioned some other things as well, like consumer confidence surveys in Australia, which are now back to quite high levels, but I don't really want to make predictions about specific markets.
Rebecca Barrett from ABC Radio News, you talked about plans to get off guarantees and an end to government intervention. How soon would you like to see that happen?
Well, again, it's very difficult for me to make comments about specific timetables. A couple of points that can be noted is that with respect to wholesale guarantees, as I said earlier, most countries that we would compare ourselves with do have specific exit timetables, and most of those for expiry of the guarantees around about the end of this year, some of them going into next year. Some of these countries have extended their guarantees after setting initial expiry dates, so all of these things aren't set in stone, and we don't know exactly what other countries are going to do, but it's just, you know, it's relevant to Australia to observe what's happening in other countries. But I think it's very important, and the RBA Governor made this comment last week in response to some questions, that it's in the interests of the borrowers themselves to take proactive steps to move into the world where they're not relying on the guarantees. And I think we've started to see that already happening in recent weeks with the amount of non-guaranteed issuance by the banks now starting to increase.
Could everyone please thank Dr. Malcolm Eadie from the Reserve Bank?
Thank you very much.